episode 136 for November 3rd, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflaw. I'll be playing the part of Fortuna.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
Okay, fine. Explain.
Well, I just recognize it. Fortuna is not a specialized fisherman. It is actually Taiki. So it is a goddess of, you know, fortune.
Which makes perfect sense in Chip's head, ladies and gentlemen. We are starting our new novel, The Time Traveler's Wife, from 2003, by one of my favorite authors, Audrey Neffenegger. I can't say it enough. I love this story. I love the way that this is put together, and I'm so happy to share it with each and every one of you.
Isn't she the John Hughes of writers?
One of the themes that we'll get into is her and my love of Chicago. And yes, Chicago is definitely a character in this story. And the nostalgia factor of remember your youth in Chicago, Chip and Pam. Remember when you were a young boy going to White Sox games in Chicago? Yes, that's definitely in this story.
Okay. So, Steve, we're going to come back to your very personal love of this novel, which was practically written for you. I will say this is my second time reading it. I read it, I don't know, in 2003 or four when it first came out. I really enjoyed it. It's been an absolute pleasure to go back to it. But I want to turn to Chip. You're reading this for the first time, my friend. What's your first impression of this first one quarter of The Time Traveler's Wife?
Well, very similar to our last story, we're kind of jumping around. We get diary entries from different dates, and you know the idea is to get accustomed to the rhythm of how to read this. And of course, most of this took place in what, Shermer, Illinois, Steve?
There ain't no Shermer in Illinois. Yes, this takes place all around the city of Chicago and the surrounding areas. And yeah, you're right that we're reading another epistolary here, aren't we? We're reading all of these. No, Pam's making a face. This is not technically an epistolary?
I don't think so.
It's diary entries, right?
Is it though?
Ooh.
Some of the material is diary entries.
So it's like a combination of, it's a combination. Oh, that's interesting. I don't think of this as an epistolary novel, but maybe I should.
Okay, but it is certainly episodic. And
is
certainly this moment in time somehow recorded by someone. And there is no narrator as such. It is first person. I did this. I had this adventure.
So I showed up naked and, you know, in front of a child. And the child got me clothing.
So. Focus. Focus, Chip. Focus. So
these are Chip's first impressions.
Oh, don't worry.
But Chip, isn't that one of the sort of wonderful things about this novel is just being in Henry's head and having that, like, this sort of horror, that sort of nightmare moment of showing up naked. Like, that's his life. It's just showing up. He doesn't know when, naked, constantly. It's a great trope to create this continual conflict all the way through the book.
It certainly had to shape his character because he had become very scrappy with that.
Sure. You know,
you're just kind of arriving someplace at any moment. And, you know, at least in the initial part, you don't even know if you can control it. You just kind of, it's kind of happening. And then you're like, okay, now I need to get clothes. I need to get resources. And of course, I'm going to meet the love of my life.
Yeah, it's really interesting that he expresses that this time travel that is a disease, this chrono displacement, he says it's like one of those dreams that you have that you show up for the test, you haven't studied, and you're naked. You don't have your wallet, you have no resources, and finding a way to survive in these situations is pretty dramatically fascinating to me.
And it's such a complicated scenario. And one of the things that I appreciated so much on the reread, and Steve, I know you do too, is just how brilliantly Audrey Neffenegger has set this up.
That is the skill of the writing of this, because this could become incredibly complicated very, very quickly.
Yeah, it's the first five words of the prologue that lines up our emotional connection to these characters, to this situation, from the first five words. Claire says, "It's hard being left behind." Those five words tell the whole story. Those five words, this idea of the time traveler's wife. We know that we're going to see time travel by buying this book. We know that there's going to be a wife when we buy this book. She says, "It's hard being left behind." He goes, and she's left to deal with the aftermath. I wait for Henry, not knowing where he is, wondering if he's okay. It's hard to be the one who stays. I keep myself busy. Time goes faster that way. I love the fact that she puts time into the staying behind character while the other character is time traveling. I get chills just thinking about those three sentences.
And I think one of the really great things about this novel, too, is that we're so used to, in time travel narratives, really focusing on the time traveler, right? The person who has that experience of moving through time. But this novel's very title, like its opening, as you've just noted, suggests, like, let's think about the other person. Let's think about the person who's just waiting and who's even less able to control this very dramatic situation.
And I love how she brings back the history here and gives us this idea. Long ago, men went to sea and women waited for them, standing on the edge of the water, scanning the horizon for the tiny ship. Now I wait for Henry. He vanishes unwillingly, without warning. I wait for him. One of my favorite things to do when I'm reading any book is to try to find the seed. What was the idea that brought the author to this whole grand story? I think that might be it. I think that might be where she thought about longing and loss and how women specifically have dealt with it through the ages and made that into this modern tale.
That reading, Stephen. I think that is one of the appeals of this novel, which has such a different take on time travel than so many other things that you and I have both read.
Then we get to freaking page 8. I have read this story probably going on 7 times now. And on page 8, there is the first moment where Henry dramatically turns around and is there in the present, and Claire, his future wife, recognizes him, and he has never met her in his life, and the chills go down my spine. This moment on freaking page 8, Audrey Neffenegger, I don't know how you did it, but it is unbelievable. I turn, prepared to start explaining again, and find myself face to face with Henry. I am speechless. Here is Henry, calm, clothed, younger than I've ever seen him. Henry is working at the Newberry Library, standing in front of me in the present, here and now. I'm jubilant. Henry is looking at me patiently, uncertain but polite. It gives me chills now reading it.
This was an interesting exploration. I was standing in line to vote when I was listening to this part. And you're correct in the sense that it's incredibly captivating. And I know in many levels, he is usually the person that comes in and finds her. But this is where we get the opposite. She finds him.
Making her the star character, the protagonist of this story, is not the time traveler.
And one of the affordances of the time travel novel is this exact moment. It's that with a time travel novel, you can have one character know another character super well, and the other character doesn't even know them at all, right? And so that notion that in our current world, you know, when we meet someone who's to become very important to us, we are exploring and getting to know each other at the same rate, mm-hmm. right? You meet someone, you spend the same amount of time with one another. But that's the great thing about the time travel narrative. You have here Claire, who's met Henry over 150 times, and you have Henry, who has never seen her before. Patient, uncertain, and polite. She's jubilant. Mm-hmm. That's just an incredible disjunct between people. And when you're studying the romance narrative, when you're studying how love can be represented, boy, that's a powerful one. And this really is a love story, right? I mean, it's about time travel. It's about deep philosophical questions, but it's fundamentally a love story. You got the love of Chicago, the love of books and art, love of family, obviously the major love story between Claire and Henry, between the time traveler and the time traveler's wife.
Let's go ahead and put on the Barry White album as we go
this
into our next.
This is romance. Section. This is true.
A little bit more than that, Chip.
This is true, absolute devotion, true love. The idea of finding your one human amongst all the 8 billion humans that is forever and for real your devotion. I love this story.
She knows his nuances. She knows this man.
Oh, this first date. The first date is just full of those moments where she's teasing him, where she's saying these things to him, and he is thrown off by this new relationship, but at the same time, he gets it.
Well, later on, as we're introduced to his experiences with her, you realize the patience and the care he took to nurture their relationship, even before it should be a relationship.
Yeah, that perspective of knowing the future, being the older man going and finding himself in this situation, this very embarrassing situation where he is naked in a field and a 5-year-old girl comes up to him, and that's very inappropriate, but he knows her. He is absolutely in love with this being, even though she is in a 5-year-old's body, and he's very, very careful. Very careful. And she's so frustrated.
Well, that plays its way, though, throughout the time, because eventually she's 8, or she's a teenager, or she is a young adult. He's taking that same care, what may be the right word, that's the same awareness of the situation and not overwhelming.
And teaching her how much their relationship means to him, and therefore having her understand it on such a deep level when she finally has that moment on page 8 where she sees him and she is beside herself with joy.
Should we talk a little bit about more? Oh, I'm sorry. Should we continue to talk a little bit more about Chicago as the background of this story?
Yeah, one of the major narrative pieces in this section, the first quarter of this book, is Henry's trip to the Field Museum of Natural History, where he, as a very young boy, is enthralled with this museum. Now, Pam, when you come visit us in Chicago, you need to visit our fantastic museums. Your children will absolutely love what our museums have put together. I have vivid memories of being a child and going to the Field Museum of Natural History and the Museum of Science and Industry, which is a very important part of the Chicago landscape. But it was the last building standing from the World's Columbian Exposition, by the way.
Hmm. Oh, wow. I didn't know that. That's cool.
Technically, it's not the same building. Technically, they rebuilt it, but just pretend.
They had to. Remember that shoddy construction that we once read about?
That's right.
So our field museum is home of Sue. It's one of the great museums in the United States, and it plays a background. In fact, eventually, Henry basically gives a tour to Henry.
That's right. That's where the time travel really, really is touching here. The very young boy, this is his first experience at the Field Museum. He loved it so much that his mind decided to take him back there late at night after he went to bed, after his parents went to bed. He time traveled for the first time. And when he gets there, he meets his guide for time traveling, who happens to be an older version of himself. And we get both perspectives, both from this extremely curious young boy having this experience, and from the man who knows what happened and knows that he's the one to make it happen. It's fascinating.
You know, it's important to, when you're touring yourself or giving yourself a tour of the Field Museum, to go ahead and learn how to pickpocket. That's probably a great skill to have.
That's later on. That's not the first tour. That's a later tour where they go and learn pickpocketing, because survival. He needs to teach himself how to survive, and he feels very conflicted about that. I'm corrupting this young boy, but at the same time, this young boy is me, and I need these skills, or I will die in these situations. Young Henry is so elated to find all this joy that he finds in the Field Museum. The older Henry remembers this trip and these feelings. He says, "A feeling I later tried to duplicate with alcohol and finally found again with Claire. A feeling of unity, oblivion, mindlessness in the best sense of the word. Being lost in the museum, being lost in the learning." Have I mentioned that I like this book?
I'm going to come back, and I'm sorry I keep cutting you off, Pam, but you know, we sometimes as adults forget what it's like to be a child, and you know, seeing something like a museum or something overwhelmingly interesting for the first time. And so she really captures it well.
She captures both perspectives so well, both the young boy being fascinated and the older man arriving in this moment and getting to see that feeling and wishing that he could feel it again. That was some of my favorite writing, where Henry says, "I wish I could feel the feelings that my younger self is feeling right now, but I get to see him going through these thoughts."
And going back to the theme of love, the love of the city, obviously the love story between our two main characters, but also the love of books and of aesthetics, of art of various kinds. I think also in the scene, there's this wonderful moment. I look at him, look at the book, remember this book, this moment, the first book I loved, remember wanting to crawl into it and sleep. That's just an awesome description of love of books, love of story.
Well, or even finding your passion. And once you find your passion, the idea is you never have to work again, because you're finding your purpose, the thing that drives you.
Mm-hmm. And all of that is highlighted by the theme of time travel. So, you know, you read novels about the love of books, you read novels about love between characters, love of city. But the time travel is really the hinge that makes this book so special. Now, I know I'm a sucker for time travel. You are too, Steve.
I've never read a time travel novel before. yes, this is my genre. So, if you give me any story and put time travel in it, I will buy your book.
And if we ask you to write a story, people in that story will time travel. I know. Now, so let's talk a little bit. And this is just podcast one of four on this novel. What do you think is so appealing about time travel? Like, what makes it a great convention for novels?
I think it's that nostalgia. It is that feeling that I remember that moment. I remember that time. I remember those people and that place. And I wish with all my heart that I could go back to that. And I know that I can't. I know that it's not possible to return to that. But what if? What if I could return to that moment? What if Tony La Russa became the manager of the Chicago White Sox and we could go back to 1979 and relive those moments again?
See, that could never happen.
No, Tony La Russa is definitely not going to be the manager. This just in, Tony La Russa has been signed as the manager of the Chicago White Sox in 2020. Wow.
That's just a 2020 thing.
It's just 2020. The time travelers may have mixed some stuff up, and 2020, it might be a glitch in the Matrix. That's what I wrote on Facebook, was this might be somebody read something mistakenly and...
That was one of my favorite memes of this week, was time travel is real and someone keeps coming back to 2020 and trying to fix things and just making it worse. Right. You know, that is kind of how it feels. But okay. Right. So I just want to throw out some ideas about time travel. So first of all, it offers authors different ways to examine relationships, as we were just talking about with Claire and Henry, where one of them knows so much more about the other. So there's this disjunct in different characters' knowledge bases. That is a very powerful narrative tool because we really don't know what's going to happen next. We can't guess. There's the wish fulfillment aspect, Steve, that you were just talking about. That idea of wanting to go back to an earlier time, that nostalgia. I think there is also a wish fulfillment in the other direction. The idea of wanting to know how things turn out. Wouldn't it be great to be able to time travel ahead? Find, or terrifying, whichever, but find out how things turn out.
Especially humanity. How does humanity get through this troublesome moment? And we're always in a troublesome moment of some sort. And time travel allows us that thinking of, it'll be okay. We, humanity, will survive. That's one of the big themes of Doctor Who, is humanity survives no matter what they go through.
Well, I'm going to add one, because you did talk about wish fulfillment, but part of that, either going back for nostalgia or being able to go back and see how things turn, go forward and see how things will turn out. There's this idea of going back to change something, if I only acted differently, there's a regret or an ability to help things turn out for the better, or what you think could be the better. Wasn't that, was it 1963? What was the Stephen King book that we read?
11/22/63.
Okay, we got a little bit of that, like everything turned even worse. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you throw out, Back to the Future, where, you know, Biff takes it back and places all the right bets and, you know, creates this situation. I mean, you could see, there's a lot of playfulness, alternate realities, alternate worlds. Things could change by just using time travel as a catalyst.
And it raises so many deep philosophical questions at that point.
Well, and I just want to, in terms of looking ahead too, I want to briefly mention the Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows, which is one of these wonderful internet projects. They come up with terms that we don't really have words for. And so one of my favorites, and I'm just looking it up, is ellipsism. Sadness that you will never be able to know how history will turn out, that you will dutifully pass on the joke of being alive without ever learning the punchline. I love that. And I think that that is one of the pleasures of time travel, is the sense that we all have of like, I feel really lucky to have been born in 1972 because I got to live the first 20 years of my life without the internet. And so I remember that feeling really, really well. And then I also get the pleasure of living the rest of my life with the internet, which I totally love. But I have that feeling. But of course, being born in 1972 means that I only get to know what happens up to, you know, maximum 2072, probably less. So that idea of like, what is your perspective on the world? That idea, my kids never knew what it was to be without the internet, but they're going to get to see into the 22nd century. That's so cool. I won't get that. So it really does, as you just said, it raises these deep philosophical questions of like, what is our time? I think it also reminds us that temporality is culturally constructed. And so you already mentioned right at the beginning, Claire talks about how time can go fast or time can go slow. Mm-hmm. So obviously, you know, in our very regimented world, we have clocks, which we count on very heavily. We now, in our internet world, your clock and my clock are identical because they're totally synced. So we have a way of measuring time that is often at a disjunct with our way of experiencing time, right? Time at the dentist's office is not the same as time at the movie theater. And pandemic time.
Remember movie theaters?
they're part of our history, Steve.
Yeah.
They're part of the historical record.
Yeah, pandemic time. Go ahead.
Pandemic time is a very complicated notion indeed, because I think we've often had that experience that it seems impossible that we've now been in pandemic mode for almost 8 months, but it also feels like it's been 20 years. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I know when time passes because eventually I'll start losing my hair.
That experience, that idea of experience and how time feels different depending on the experience is so well documented in this story of time travel and slow time and fast time.
And I actually would go further than say documented. I would say it's embodied, because that's what literature does, right? It embodies the feelings that we have. It puts them into words that we can then feel viscerally as we read. And so that's what's, I think, very powerful about a lot of time travel narratives, and perhaps this one in particular.
I'm going to quote Keanu Reeves at this point. He says, "Whoa."
Yes. That's a good Keanu Reeves quote. Thank you. Is that from a time travel story, Chip?
Probably.
No, that's from a Shakespeare play. Good.
Whoa.
The most righteous Claudio. So one of the things that time travel can do is split off into alternate realities and parallel universes. And that's one of the things that Audrey is very careful not to do in this story.
Well, in fact, that is an author's choice. And the idea that... you could easily see that every time I go back to a time and I make a change or experience that time, it could create an alternate reality. Well, she says no, that there is only one time stream. And when I go back, that, well, this eventually will come into, you know, fate and how it all works out. We'll have to talk to Taiki about that. But she, as the author, says, there's one timeline, this is what happens, and when you go back there, you're just experiencing it.
And it's interesting because Henry and Claire talk about this when she's really young, and he says to a very young Claire, it's part of the rules. People who time travel aren't supposed to go around talking to regular people while they visit their times, because we might mess things up. Actually, I don't believe this. Things happen the way they happened, once and only once. I'm not a proponent of splitting universes. Now, by telling us that he is not a proponent of splitting universes, Henry is telling us he has no idea what he's talking about. There are proponents of split or parallel universes, which means he's just giving us his own personal take. And he talks a lot about that sort of epistemological construction of meaning in his early conversations with Claire. And so when he talks to Claire, I believe she's 13 in this scene, he has this analysis of her belief system. Claire is silent. Her pragmatism and her romantic feelings about Jesus and Mary are, at 13, almost equally balanced. A year ago, she would have said God without hesitation. In 10 years, she will vote for determinism. And 10 years after that, Claire will believe that the universe is arbitrary, that if God exists, he does not hear our prayers, that cause and effect are inescapable and brutal, but meaningless. Hmm. So he is telling us as we're reading this book, hey, this is just one way of seeing the question of time, of seeing the question of free will. This notion, if you're traveling in the past, you can't change anything. That's just Henry's belief. That's not necessarily the truth.
And if there's a such thing as splitting universes and the multiverse and choices peel off in alternate timelines, he would never know it because he's in his timeline doing the time traveling that he's doing and saying nothing changes because I see that nothing changes because nothing changes in his universe because he sees it. It's wonderful.
Something tells me that we should be having this conversation maybe at a hookah bar.
But it's a true cognitive pleasure, right? Because as soon as you think, oh, I've got this, it slips away philosophically. And now you have to sort of chase the notion of meaning construction,
and,
which is, you know, both pleasurable and endlessly frustrating.
And that's like, why time travel stories are the best stories.
Exactly. Now,
I
let
win
me
book club.
But, good segue, Steve, because let me pause and say, okay, this book is awesome and it's all about love, but it's got some pretty dark elements, my friends. And I think we would be remiss to read the first quarter of this book without acknowledging some very dark and creepy things. So, Chip, how did you feel about the fact that Henry is in love with like a 7-year-old, a 10-year-old, that he gets to like teach the multiplication tables to the love of his life when she's a child and he's like a 30-year-old man?
Well, I think the author certainly recognized some of the challenges of these types of meetings. And she chose that Henry would certainly be very conscious of how he released information to her. Not that he's releasing the future, but certainly on how they would talk about things. Because young people are just getting that information sometimes. He certainly is in a position you're going, wait a minute, we're going to be married in the future. I'm talking to a 5-year-old or I'm talking to an 8-year-old. And just recognizing like, oh my goodness, we've got to keep things on a certain decorum. And I think she did a pretty good job about it until we get to like an incredible scene where something really bad happens to Claire and she decides she's going to be, you know, vigilante.
Yeah, that scene was darker than I remembered. The revenge scene against the football player where I thought it was really brilliantly done because she tells Henry, I'm going to need you to help me get revenge. And he's like, okay. You know, he's an older guy at this point. She's, I believe, 16. And she shows up with a handgun, which he's not super comfortable with. I was happy he took the bullets out of it, made me feel better. But then as they take this boy, this football player, who's also presumably 16, 17 years old, and duct tape him naked to a tree, there's moments where like Henry looks at Claire and he sees this whole other side of her. She's all like femme fatale. And then the boy has asthma. Now, the boy is a sexual predator as well, right? And so I think that there's a really, really super complex representation of this kid. But the fact that he has asthma, and Claire's like, no problem, I'll get his inhaler, she says coldly. We can continue the torture. We'll just give him some puffs of air. It's a very dark scene, but it's also something that connects them. And they never talk about it again.
It's character development for sure. It is definitely the really deep character who is Claire is brought to the surface here. And Henry is seeing this aspect of the love of his life and going, ooh, boy, this might be problematic.
Well, and let's set this up properly. Claire had not been dating because she knows that she has this future relationship with Henry. And she was being teased at school. So she chose to take a date with the next person who asked her that was a football star. And I mean, I don't know if it was ever determined that she was raped, but he beat her. And then he burned her with a cigarette, which left a scar that she still has as an adult. And so she was incredibly angry. And I don't know if the author is writing this as wish fulfillment in the sense of, you know, most people who experience something incredibly horrific don't ever get a chance to go back and perform a revenge act on that person. But they, with Henry, who is a person who pops in and pops out of reality, who could pop out of reality when they're performing this, ends up going and they grab this kid out of his house, take him to the woods, cut off his clothing, strap him to a tree, and eventually Henry just kicks him right in the groin at the end of it. This is certainly very, very dark. When it gets out that this has happened, there's a scene in the gym where everyone is incredibly quiet about this event happening. And she takes off her shirt to get ready for PE class or something of that nature. And she turns around and shows all the bruises that are on her back from where this football player beat her, which led to this event happening. This is certainly an incredibly powerful and dark scene.
And then the girls cheer, right?
Oh, yeah.
So this is like seen as a vigilante act and a justified one. Mm-hmm. So it's a really powerful scene. And again, sets up that complexity of both the characters, but also their relationship, the different levels that they have.
Isn't the next scene where he pops back in the future and he touches the scar or looks at the scar? There's something that ends up happening with the scar.
Because now he knows where it came from. She had never talked about it before.
And there again is that nature of time travel, that ability for us to have the nostalgia of a time and to go back to a time and have that moment that maybe needed to be had. That revenge moment was maybe the right thing for the nostalgia, the idea of the character. Yes, this is a dark, dark piece.
I think it gets more complex than that. I think this is... I mean, we all have character flaws, and certainly violence against violence. I don't know. I mean, is that justified? Well, mm-hmm. Yeah, these become much deeper than that. And I need a few more glasses of wine before we can
there. Well, it's another one of those big philosophical questions that this book tackles, which is just one of many, many, many. So as we start to wrap up, and I'm thinking, again, this is just podcast one of four, so we'll be able to talk about this more as we go further, but it's very interesting. There are a number of ways to set up time travel. Time travel can reside, obviously, in science fiction. You can have a time machine. This can be a scientific advance, right? In which you actually break through the fourth dimension and you can time travel. It can be set up as fantasy. We don't really know how this works, but in this world, part of the world building is that time travel is possible. Or in literary fiction, it can be set up as postmodernism, somewhat in parallel to the question of different constructions. So I kept thinking about queer identities as I was reading this. And again, this has to do with my position in time. The fact that when I started grad school in the 90s, it was pretty exciting to think about gender as a social construction. And today, when I tell my students about this research, they're like, of course, gender is a social construction. I have tons of trans friends who used to be female, whatever that means, and are now male, whatever that means. And so like 25 years after, my mind was blown in the 90s by the idea that gender is a social construction. Students just accept it as an ordinary part of life. Now, when I say time is a social construction, I think we're like, no, time is pretty solid. We can measure it on clocks. Look, your clock is the same as my clock. But I feel like this is a sort of philosophical question, different theories of time that is being sort of pried apart right now and has been for years and years. But I think that I suspect we're at the cusp of a major change in thinking around time. And that may well be because we are, hate to say it, in the middle of a climate crisis that is an existential threat to the human race. So these questions, I mean, I think that this novel is such an awesome novel to read in 2020 as we're thinking about time in different ways and as literary fiction is thinking of time in this very postmodern way. So I just want to come back to this question as we learn more. But what's the impact of making Henry's time travel some sort of disease, a chrono displacement, as she calls it? It's kind of not quite sci-fi. It's not quite fantasy. Mm-hmm. It's something very postmodern and really dedicated to the epistemological conundrum of time that's really central to our thinking today.
It's the catalyst. You had to figure out how it works, and she had to make a choice. Eventually, it just has to happen. So,
and it's put together so well. Like she touches on all the theories of time travel so carefully, but so quickly that, yes, this is a thing. Yes, there might be free will. I love the scene where Henry is talking to himself and saying, you know, there is no free will. Things just happen the way they happen, but you have to act like there's free will. Otherwise, there's consequences to your choices. It's riding the line between yes and no, but in such a wonderful way that it makes sense. I like the fact that we have the timey-wimey-ness of this story. The idea of jumping back and forth, going to this narrative, and how Audrey has put together in this first part the development of Claire's character from this woman whom we meet in the prologue suffering loss back to this five-year-old and her diary entry where she first writes down on paper about her meeting with Henry as a very young girl is so pitch perfect. Literature-wise, that's how a young kid writes. And then we see the maturation of that character very quickly because of the fast-forwarding of the time travel.
I'm just glad that there's no Skynet and Austrian accents.
This was definitely written at the very beginning of the World Wide Web, where the World Wide Web, I love one of the offshoot things that he says when he gets into the Field Museum is this was an era before motion detectors. So he could walk throughout this building. The technology certainly changes what you can do in a different era. And yes, storytelling changes throughout time. Interesting.
And guys, this story is so well written. Doesn't it kind of make you want to write something yourself?
You know, if I could just have like a 30-day obligation in front of me.
That's kind of what I was thinking, my friends.
Oh, Professor. Yes.
So your good friend in Connecticut invites you, as you know, to join us for NaNoWriMo. Talk to us, Steve. What's happening?
NaNoWriMo, the National Novel Writing Month, is upon us. Today is day 3, and the idea of NaNoWriMo is to create your novel, to put it down on paper, to get those ideas out of your head, and to commit to another project in November.
And don't be intimidated by amazing writers like Audrey Niffenegger, who put this together so brilliantly, because in the month of November, you're not worrying about brilliant organization and moving between your scenes. You're just writing. You're just getting words out there. You're adding to your already crazy schedule, but you're also getting out of your head a little bit and putting yourself into a different world and creating something.
Time is an illusion. Lunchtime, doubly so.
Well, you've prepared for this. You know, we read a Sherlock Holmes short story or a chapter every day. Mm-hmm. You know, from the beginning of COVID, you know, for 3 or 4 months, you've got a body of knowledge you can pull from to be able to put together this topic obligation. It should take you similar amount of time to organize yourself, to express yourself for the first time.
I disagree with that math, my friend. I think it's going
to take a lot more time. You're not a math person, though, so it's fine.
I think it's fine. My math is probably wrong. You're right. It's going to take more time than that. I disagree with you. But everybody out there, you should join us. You should join us and write down your thoughts. What's your story that you need to get out there? Join us during NaNoWriMo. Go to NaNoWriMo.org, and you can find us and join up and be a part of the creation of something new.
Wow, you said that like you were really selling it, Steve.
At now,
whether you're writing Sherlock Holmes fan fiction, whether you're writing a time travel narrative, whether you're writing that story that you always wanted to write, I do think 2020, don't let it get you down. 2020 is the year you write a novel, 50,000 words in 30 days. It's only 1,667 words a day. You got this. Join us at NaNoWriMo.org.
That's selling it. Good job. All right, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve, or at least find a time travel way of coming back.
I think I'm going to come back a month ago.
Oh.
I think I'm going to come back a month from now, after my novel is written.
What do you think, Pam? You all set? We all set for part two of The Time Traveler's Wife?
Super excited to be reading on.
Steve, where are we reading?
Yeah, Chip, that is one thing that is a little frustrating about reading this together is there are no breaks. There are no milestones. There are no chapters. It's just these little vignette stories one after another. Okay, Pam, you're in charge of assignments. So what's our assignment for next week?
All right, guys, read through the end of part one. So depending on the edition you have, there are several different editions of this novel, including audio. So when you hit part two, a drop of blood in a bowl of milk. Stop right there. That's where we're stopping.
All right. We'll try to coordinate with this. That's one thing that we're going to have to keep working on is where does time start and stop in this novel? And we'll never find out. We'll never know if we're on the right page or not. It's emblematic.
Oh my goodness.
We would love to hear from you. We would love to hear if you are reading this along with us. Do you love this as much as I do? Are you putting up with it as much as Chip is? Thank you, Chip, for putting up with us this week, by the way. And we would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4867. Our website is sandwichesatirregularhours.com. Our email is sandwichesatirregularhours@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and YouTube when I remember to post it. It'll be there. You'll be there eventually, or I'll go back in time and post it early. Yeah, oh, that's a good idea. I want to thank you again for listening to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Chip Hasselblo as Fortuna.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
We'll see you in the future, or the past, or somewhere in between.
Well, I'm going to have to light some incense next time.